Observatório de Regionalismo. Thanks, Professor Rhys, so much for your interview. And for this interview, we would like to talk about four main topics that are from your researches. First one being comparative regionalism, then global governance, identity and regionalism, and the diffusion of regionalism and norms. So recently, you and Professor Tanya Borzo have published a book on the Oxford Handbook on Comparative Regionalism. What is the importance of rising up this debate?
I think the main issue is to really engage into comparative regionalism. There's a lot of studies, or have been a lot of studies, looking at different regions. So you have these people, a huge community studying the European Union and thinking the European Union is the only thing there is and all the rest is irrelevant. Then you have a community of Africanists looking at African regions and so on. And so we thought what we should do is really force our authors to look across regions. We still have chapters on the various continents, but in that handbook that you mentioned, the main emphasis is really comparing across regions, because you can learn a lot about what explains, what are the main drivers for regionalism and the emergence of regional organizations. You know, what are actually their effects? Do they have any effects? Is it just talk? And so forth. And you can only come up with some explanatory factors if you compare. And that's the beauty of comparative regionalism. It's, in a way, it's social sciences 101, because social sciences is all about comparisons.
About global governance, what roles do the regions play right now in our system to achieving global governance?
First of all, most regional organizations are regional governance organizations. You know, they engage in various issue areas, be it security, be it economic governance, be it climate, environmental governments, human rights governments. I mean, we have in the human rights areas, we have all kinds of regional human rights regimes. And sometimes this works as a kind of implementation of larger global regimes. So, in the human rights area, that is definitely the case. You know, you have a global human rights regimes, and then you have, particularly in the Americas and in Europe, very strong regional human rights regimes that kind of implement these global norms into a regional context, and therefore can also be way more context specific. Yeah. But there are also cases, I mean, on the opposite, where regional organizations work at cross-purpose with global governance themes. There is an ongoing debate on whether regional economic organizations actually divert trade or foster trade, yeah, or whether they are compliant with the World Trade Organization rules, etc. So that's an ongoing debate. Yeah, I mean, most of the evidence suggests that it's again complementary. Yeah, just because you have a very strong single market in Europe doesn't mean that Europe doesn't trade with the rest of the world. So there's very little evidence for trade diversion, but it's an ongoing debate. So in some cases, it promotes global governance regimes, and in other cases, it works against them. So.
In your point of view, how does identity issues influence the development of regionalism?
That's actually a very complicated question, because it's not, one cannot say that strong regional identities translate immediately into regional institutions. Many regional organizations are based on what is called open-ended contracts. Think about the European Union. It's an open-ended contract. States came together, the Rome treaties, etc., but it's not finished. It's evolving. It's always evolving. And without, my point would be, if you do not have some sense of regional community, yeah, and this is identity, this open-endedness is not workable, because you cannot trust your partners that that actually this is open-ended in the future. So for that you need some sort of community spirit. Now, we're not talking very strong identifications with the regions. And by the way, people have multiple identities. You know, you can be Brazilian, you can be wedded to Sao Paulo, you are Paulisto or Paulista, yeah? And you can have an identification with the West. I don't know about Latin American identity, that's a different story. I think it's pretty weak, but you can also identify with your region. And the data that we have for Europe show that if people only have, even people that have only sort of minimum attachment to Europe, are strongly supporting European integration way more so than people who only identify with their own nation state. Yeah. So we do not need identities, you know, die for Europe, you know, in order to have regional integration going. So that's the one issue. So we have quite some good evidence that, that citizen identities have something to do with the ability of political elites to really foster regional integration. The second point is, and that's just an observation, and we do not really know what effects it has. In almost every case of region building, political elites make a sustained effort at creating a regional identity. Yeah, you have, they come up with a flag for the regional organization, symbolism. In Africa, they talk about the African way, you know, and that is community building, right? In ASEAN, they said the Asian way, and they distanced that from Europe and so forth. So elites, when they engage in region building, they almost inevitably talk identity talk. Yeah, and it's not just about economic interests. It's almost always about that identity talk. Unfortunately, we do not know what the effects of this are, because particularly data or studies of Europe, where we have the best data available, it's very hard to show that the European integration process itself had any effects on popular identification. It's very hard to show. Yeah, and at the moment, I would bet that the way is more from identity to regional integration than the other way around. It might be a kind of virtuous circle with a feedback effect, but the effect from regional identities or identification with the region to region building is probably stronger than the other way around.
And our last question is about diffusion. Okay. You have done so much work on diffusion and some really important work to the field. We would like to know what are the main points of this agenda right now? You were talking in the last question about the Asian way, the African way. How can we perceive diffusion on regional organizations and on regionalism in general?
Okay, let me back off a bit. Most of our theoretical understandings of region building or regionalism, theories of regional integration assume, you know, that the states or political elites in a region have a certain functional problem, you know, economic, security or whatever, and then look for a functional solution to that. And they don't look around what other regions have done. And the diffusion argument is simple, that in fact they do look around. You learn from other regions, and sometimes you reject something from other regions, it will also be a diffusion effect. You make a conscious choice not to follow the European way, for example. Yeah, in the Asian example, that has been done for quite a while. You know, so the diffusion perspective, I'm not saying that the regions are dummies, you know, that just download some software. You know, the European model spreads across the world. That's probably nonsense. But regions do learn from each other. They also learn from experiences within a region. I mean, in Latin America, you have UNASUR, MERCOSUR, ALBA, CELAC, whatever. I mean, we have tons of. We call it the Latin American alphabet soup of regions. Overlapping regionalism, etc. And I'd say chances are that particularly institutional designs have been copied, you know, between these various organizations. Yeah, so it's about interdependent decision making. The choices of somebody before affects what you are doing.
Okay. Thank you so much once again, Professor Rees. Our research group thanks you. And
thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.